The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. This issue is a double issue, so it is dated February 4th, 2019, and also dated February 11th, 2019. So this is 2 weeks' worth of Time Magazine. Going right to the beginning of the book, we come to the regular feature called For the Record, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a line drawing or a bold headline, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Anthony Lesseritz, director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, after a survey showed a significant spike in the percentage of Americans worried about climate change. In the quotation from Anthony Lesseritz, quote, "I've never seen jumps in some of the key indicators like this," unquote. In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount in red, $25,000. Caption explains, "Money raised last year to fund the search for a mate for a rare Bolivian frog named Romeo. A Juliet was found, and scientists hoping to help save the species have now planned a, quote, date, unquote, for them on Valentine's Day." In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. Under Bad Week, Ariana Grande. Several rappers say her new single, Seven Rings, is overly similar to their work. Under Good Week, Grande to go. Starbucks, with the help of Uber Eats, plans to expand delivery service for mobile users. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic 10% in bright red. Caption explains, percentage of Transportation Security Administration screeners absent from work on January 20th, an agency record, on day 30 of the partial government shutdown. In the left-center margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from George W. Bush, 43rd U.S. President, in a January 18th Instagram post showing him delivering pizza to Secret Service personnel who have been working without pay. The quotation from 43rd U.S. President George W. Bush, quote, "It's time for leaders on both sides to put politics aside, come together, and end this showdown," quote, unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Rudy Giuliani, legal advisor to President Trump, to The New Yorker on whether it would be, quote, problematic, unquote, if Trump had been involved in discussions of a Moscow real estate project during his campaign without the knowledge of the American people. The quotation from Rudy Giuliani, legal advisor to President Trump, in bright red, quote, "I'm a criminal lawyer. I am not an ethicist," unquote. The top center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Spike Lee, director, reacting to his first Academy Award nomination for directing for Black Klansman. The quotation in black and all caps, quote, "30 years is a long time, ain't it?" unquote. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cambridge, on the importance of a new UK hotline offering advice for parents and caregivers. The quotation from Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cambridge, quote, "You get a lot of support with the baby as a mother, particularly in the early days, but after the age of one, it falls away," unquote. Now, the entire contents of the For the Record page. And that brings us to the opening section of Time Magazine, opening major section called The Brief. In the subsection called The Bulletin, the headline is, "An uprising in Sudan threatens to dismantle three decades of authoritarian rule," by Aaron Baker. For nearly 30 years, President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has ruled Sudan with an authoritarian zeal that makes him among the world's most notorious dictators. Accused of severe human rights abuses, corruption, and economic incompetence. Sanctions and condemnation have had little effect, but a popular uprising, now in its second month, is sending cracks through the once unassailable edifice of his regime. And here, Aaron Baker lists three examples. First example, "Let them eat bread." What began on December 19th as a riot in the city of Atbara over the price of bread soon morphed into a nationwide anti-al-Bashir movement. Throngs of young protesters, Sudan's median age is 19, have filled the streets calling for freedom, peace, and justice. Authorities have arrested more than 1,000 and killed 40, according to Amnesty International. But the near-daily demonstrations continue. Quote, "People are hungry, and they see the looting of the country's resources by the ruling clique," unquote, said Sudanese-British billionaire Mohammed Ibrahim. Quote, "When they are pushed against the wall, they just have nothing to lose," unquote. Second item, solidarity at last. Al-Bashir's government is no stranger to unrest, but there are signs that the latest uprising has him rattled. The 75-year-old calls the protesters, quote, "traitors," unquote, and blames the violence on rebels from Sudan's Darfur region, a once effective tactic that seems to have lost its teeth. His opponents say diverse ethnic groups are finally united against their president after years of his exploiting divisions. Protesters now chant, quote, "We are all Darfur," unquote, referring to the genocide that in 2009 made al-Bashir the first serving head of state ever to be indicted by the International Criminal Court. Third item, turning the tide. The harsh crackdown has drawn the professional classes to the cause. Doctors and lawyers are coordinating many of the rallies. Al-Bashir has insisted he will not step down and says only that he will respect the will of the people in elections slated for 2020. But the Sudanese have lost faith in the country's rigged election system. Now in the streets and sensing weakness, they may not stop until they get the response they are waiting for. Entire article by Aaron Baker. Aaron, by the way, is spelled A-R-Y-N, Aaron Baker. On this page is the recurring sidebar feature called News Ticker, a collection of news items stacked one on top of the other. Always three. Top item, protests met with violence in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, called on January 22nd for a probe into alleged violence by security forces after at least 12 people were killed and hundreds injured in the wake of protests that broke out after a fuel price increase was announced. Middle item, Supreme Court to hear gun case. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed on January 22nd to hear its first Second Amendment case in 9 years, a move that may signal a willingness by the now majority conservative court to weigh in on gun control issues. The case, a challenge to a New York City rule restricting where some licensed gun owners can carry their weapons, will be heard next term. Final item. Gene editing science, correction, gene editing scientist reprimanded. The Chinese scientist who claims he created the world's first genetically edited babies acted illegally and will be punished, state media reported on January 21st. He has also been fired from his university job. In November, He Jong-kul said he had altered the genes of twin girls' embryos to make them resistant to HIV. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, and we are now at the major subsection called Milestones. Lead item. Under died Mary Oliver, poet of a captivating world. Observance by Katie Steinmetz. If you know only one line of Mary Oliver's poetry, it is likely a question she posed, one that sums up the infectious wonder that ran through her verse like veins through a leaf. Quote, "Tell me," unquote, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet wrote in The Summer Day, quote, "what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Unquote. Your reader will read that line uninterrupted by time's punctuation, and it is, quote, "Tell me what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Unquote. Oliver, who had been treated for lymphoma, died at her home in Hobe Sound, Florida, on January 17th. She was 83 and a rarity even among poets. She was not merely prolific. The Ohio native published more than 20 volumes of verse, including American Primitive, the collection that won the Pulitzer in 1984. Her work also sold well. Writers borrowed her lines as epigraphs, and readers held them close and taped them up and tweeted them out and even tattooed them, because Oliver gave fresh spirit to old ideas in purposefully plain speech. She found perspective in the march of seasons. She envied the secret lives of animals. She reminded her readers that life is a blessing, that mischief can be healing, that uncertainty isn't a reason to disbelieve. She also left us with helpful instructions, some written as she grappled with getting older and wondering what comes next. Quote, keep some room in your heart, unquote, Oliver wrote in 2009, quote, for the unimaginable. Unquote. And your reader will repeat that line correctly and uninterrupted by time's punctuation. The line is, quote, keep some room in your heart for the unimaginable. Unquote. Entire observance by Katie Steinmetz on Mary Oliver, poet. This item is accompanied by a color headshot or an upper body shot of Mary Oliver, and the caption explains, in addition to her Pulitzer Prize, Oliver, shown here in 2013, received the National Book Award for Poetry in 1992. Still on Milestones, on the right margin of the page, under ordered, trans troop ban enforced. Subtitle, legal battle. Item by W.J. Hennigan. few barriers remain to keep whole classes of Americans from serving in the military. On January 22nd, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled to maintain one of the last such hurdles, allowing President Donald Trump's policy on transgender troops to go into effect while a legal fight unfolds. The unsigned order isn't a final decision. The justices denied the administration's request for one, but it cleared a path for the Department of Defense to enforce the rule, which bans most trans Americans from serving in the military and requires troops to serve, quote, in their biological sex, unquote, or else be, quote, presumptively disqualified, unquote. That's a win for the White House, which argued that military readiness and effectiveness were in jeopardy. Parenthetically, a 2016 RAND report found allowing trans troops would likely have, quote, minimal impact on readiness, unquote. It would take years for one of the ongoing cases about the policy to make its way to the Supreme Court, but advocates on both sides see this order as an omen. When a case does eventually come up, it suggests the justices are likely to uphold the policy again. Entire item by W.J. Hennigan. Under died Russell Baker, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer who wrote the Observer column for the New York Times for decades, on January 21st, at 93. I'll repeat that. Russell Baker died on January 21st at 93. Under died Mazo Nonaka, who held the title of the world's oldest man at 113 years and 179 days on January 20th. Mazo Nonaka. Under announced that California Senator Kamala Harris is running for president on January 21st, her campaign raised $1.5 million in its first 24 hours, matching Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' record from his 2016 bid. Under sentenced, Egyptian TV presenter Mohamed Al-Ghaiti to 1 year of hard labor by the Egyptian government for interviewing an anonymously gay man last year. Under opened, a record 33,341 murder probes by Mexican investigators in 2018, up from the previous record of 25,036 in 2017. 33,341 murder probes by Mexican investigators in 2018. Under nominated, the Netflix movie Roma for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture, Netflix's first nomination in the top category. Black Panther became the first superhero movie to be nominated for Best Picture. Under elected, New York Yankees closer Mariano Rivera to the Baseball Hall of Fame on January 22nd. He was the first player ever chosen unanimously. Entire content of Milestones. On the facing page is the regular feature called Good Question. And here the question is the headline, Can Trump Revive His Deal with North Korea? Article by Charlie Campbell. In the first meeting, if the first meeting was about making friends, the second means getting down to business. The White House said January 18th that President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will sit down before the end of February in an attempt to inject life into a denuclearization process that has stalled since their June summit in Singapore. If the second meeting is going to make a difference, Trump will need Kim to offer up something real. Over the past year, Kim has returned three U.S. hostages and the remains of troops killed during the Korean War, and destroyed a redundant nuclear testing site. But his nuclear and missiles programs have continued unabated. At the very least, Washington needs a full inventory of North Korea's ballistic missiles and nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons arsenals and facilities. Just 3 days after the summit was announced, a Washington, D.C. think tank released a report revealing a secret North Korean missile base, the existence of which had not been declared by the country's authorities. The next step would be returning International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors to those sites and agreeing on a firm dismantlement schedule. Any deal, argues Sung-Yoon Lee, professor of Korean studies at Tufts University, must be implemented on the basis of, quote, verification instead of illusory concessions, unquote. In exchange, Kim would get a phased rollback of UN sanctions. But sanctions relief is a double-edged sword for the dictator. Boosting the livelihoods of his people would entail the risk of opening up North Korean society. Plus, sanctions enforcement by China, across whose border nearly all North Korean trade passes, has already crumbled amid Trump's trade war and Kim's warming relations with President Xi Jinping. Kim's priority is a striking a deal that was a typo that your reader did read. I will repeat it without the typo. Kim's priority is striking a deal that formally ends the Korean War, which concluded with a 1953 armistice that would undercut the justification for keeping U.S. forces in South Korea and Japan, which host 28,500 and 54,000 American troops, respectively. South Korea, 28,500. Japan, 54,000. Sean King, a risk analyst and former U.S. diplomat, suspects Kim will offer to dismantle his ICBMs, which can theoretically hit the U.S., in return for Trump's removing regional strategic assets and troops. Trump has already said he wants to withdraw troops from South Korea, and in June agreed to suspend joint South Korea-U.S. military drills, which was a red line for the U.S. since 1996. Quote, why wouldn't Trump jump at such an opportunity, unquote, King says, noting that he could then simply redefine successful denuclearization as having secured the U.S. mainland. That version of security could leave South Korea exposed and isolated. But Trump is facing trouble at home, including the government shutdown and no signs of a breakthrough in trade negotiations with China. In this situation, the self-styled master dealmaker may be keen to secure a deal, any deal, whatever the cost. Entire article by Charlie Campbell. Running along the bottom of this page, under this major heading, History, the headline is Not So Ancient Artifacts by George Steer. Scottish archaeologists ended research into a stone circle thought to be centuries old after it emerged that a farmer built it in the 1990s. Here, more artificial antiquities. And George Steer lists three running left to right across the bottom of the page. Far left, the first item, counterfeit crown. In 1896, the Louvre said it had bought the golden tiara of an ancient Scythian king. Several years later, after experts raised questions, the crown was revealed to be a fake made by an Odessa goldsmith. Middle item, fake fossils. Skull and jawbone fragments said to be found in a gravel pit in Piltdown, England, were unveiled in 1912 as the, quote, missing link, unquote, in human evolution. Four decades later, new technology helped expose the fossils as forgeries. That was Gravel Pit in Piltdown, England. Last item on the far right, Under Wraps. That's W-R-A-P-S, Under Wraps. In 1969, the Old Capitol Museum in Mississippi removed an Egyptian mummy that had been on display since the 1920s after a medical student x-rayed it and realized it was composed of papier-mâché, and nails. Egyptian mummy. In the left-hand margin of the page is another edition of News Ticker, and again comprised of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item. Taliban resumes talks after killings. Dozens of people were killed in a Taliban attack on an Afghan intelligence base on January 21st, the same day as the militant group, which holds large swaths of Afghanistan, said it restarted peace talks with U.S. officials. Middle item. Google fined under new EU data law. France's Data Protection Commission hit Google with a nearly $57 million fine on January 21st for violation of the EU's General Data Protection Regulation rules introduced last year. The regulatory group accused the tech giant of, quote, lack of transparency, inadequate information, and lack of valid consent, unquote, regarding the personalization of ads. Bottom item. Questions remain on BuzzFeed Trump report. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office denied unnamed aspects of a BuzzFeed news story alleging that President Trump instructed his now former lawyer Michael Cohen to lie to Congress. BuzzFeed stood by the January 17th story, which had sparked talk of impeachment among some members of Congress. Moving ahead, still in the brief, and we are now in the regular brief feature called Time With, and here, this edition has Time With TV host Michael Strawn. Time says, Michael Strawn keeps tabs on the Super Bowl while expanding his horizons, by Sean Gregory. As a bruising lineman for the New York Giants, Michael Strawn used to do battle with 320-pound behemoths every Sunday. Now, on a recent Friday morning at a New York City television studio, he's dancing with an elderly woman to Cake by the Ocean. In his current gig as co-host of the highly caffeinated third hour of Good Morning America, known as GMA Day, Strawn does his fair share of pumping up the crowd. GMA Day is a bit like a designer steroid version of Live with Kelly and Ryan, which Strawn co-hosted with Kelly Ripa in its Live with Kelly and Michael iteration before a tabloid-friendly breakup ended their run in 2016. An expert offers tips for decluttering your cell phone, and the studio audience emits woos, as if someone had just won a new car. Parenthetically, in fairness, they're good tips. Unsubscribe from those lists. And there's dancing. So much dancing. Strawn enters the studio, getting down to Missy Elliott's Get Your Freak On. After a sweet segment with a 10-year-old boy who donated $100 of his own money to help cover the unpaid lunch bills of his classmates, Strawn writhes on the floor doing the worm. Reminder, it's 10:30 a.m. on a Friday. Backstage after the taping, Even Strawn questions how he summons the excess pep. Quote, I'm going. What's wrong with you? Unquote, says Strawn. Quote, it's weird. Unquote. The performances are paying off. Strawn, the affable former football star, with an instantly recognizable gap-toothed smile, now counts as one of the hottest commodities on television, having launched an unconventional post-NFL career that's the envy of many of his peers. Sure, Strawn joins a merry bunch of ex-jocks like the guffawing Terry Bradshaw and the studious Howie Long talking football on Fox's Sunday pregame show. But that's just part of his broadcast portfolio. In addition to his role on GMA Day, he's a co-anchor on Good Morning America, an executive producer and star of ABC's reboot of the $100,000 Pyramid game show. None of that fits the typical former athlete game plan. During a GMA interview in early January, Strawn pressed comedian Kevin Hart about past homophobic tweets that ultimately cost Hart his slot on as Oscar's host. Hart came across as defiant. Strawn, a friend of Hart's, refused to let him off easy. None of which is to say Strawn isn't turning his attention toward February 3rd and the Super Bowl matchup between the New England Patriots and the Los Angeles Rams. Strawn knows a bit about dethroning the Pats' Tom Brady. Back in 2008, his Giants upset the Patriots, costing New England a perfect 19-0 season. He encourages the Rams to enter this year's Super Bowl with the same defiance he saw in his teammates. Quote, we know they've beaten everybody under the sun, unquote, says Strawn, who in conversation circles his hands and touches his chest when animated. Quote, we know that they can prepare for anybody. Well, now is time to start our history. This is our time. F their time. Unquote. In the interest of including as much material from this double issue as possible, we do move on from this article. We will include a brief fact sheet listed in the middle of one of the pages under Strawn Quick Facts. It's three items. Top item is Busy Fellow. Besides his on-air duties on five different TV programs, Strawn launched a clothing line at JCPenney and co-owns a talent and production company. Second item, Sack King. In 2002, Strawn set the NFL single-season sack record in controversial fashion. Brett Favre took a tumble to hand it to him. Quote, if someone doesn't like it, unquote, he says, quote, just break it, unquote. Final item, Trophy Case. He won two Emmy Awards for his work on Live with Kelly and Michael. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, we come to the regular feature called Lightbox, which is always a two-page photographic spread. Therefore, we don't give it much attention usually in our reading, but here the caption does give us enough information to make sense out of what is in the photograph. The title of the item is Boxed In. Caption says, Paul Whelan, the former U.S. Marine accused by Russia of being a spy, speaks to his lawyers from the defendant's cage during a pretrial hearing in Moscow on January 22nd. His court-appointed lawyer has acknowledged that Whelan was carrying, quote, information constituting state secrets, unquote, on a flash drive when arrested in December, but said Whelan hadn't opened the drive, which he thought held travel photos. Whelan, who maintains he is innocent of an unspecified, quote, act of espionage, unquote, faces up to 20 years in prison. photographed by Mladen Antonov for AFP Getty Images. And the photograph does show Whelan in a blue Oxford shirt in a glass enclosure talking through the glass door to a female and a male, one of them presumably his attorney and one presumably an interpreter. Now entering the second major section of the magazine, The View. And here we come to the regular feature, The Risk Report. The headline is, Tunisia's fledgling democracy shows signs of wear and tear, by Ian Bremmer. Tunisia will forever be remembered as the birthplace of the Arab Spring in 2011. That has been both a blessing and a curse for the country. The upside is that democracy and reform have become focal points of national pride in a region badly in need of both, especially after the architects of the transition won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015. The downside is that Tunisia's halting progress continues to disappoint those who hope others will follow its path. Egypt's retreat into dictatorship, Libya's fragmentation, and Syria's catastrophic war make Tunisia that much more important for those who insist that the awakening continues. 8 years after the uprising, many Tunisians are angry at how their newly democratic state is faring. The unemployment rate for graduates is about 30%. For those who have jobs, wages remain stagnant, and GDP per capita is down since 2014. Tens of thousands have fled the country in search of better prospects. Little wonder, then, that demonstrations have become commonplace in recent years. According to the Tunisian Forum for Economic and Social Rights, their number has surged from 5,001 in 2015 to more than 11,000 last year. The most recent at this writing came on January 17th, when Tunisia's largest labor union staged a nationwide strike to demand better pay for state employees. Timed to mark the democratic uprising's anniversary, it was joined by hundreds of thousands of workers and brought much of the country's rail, road, and air traffic to a halt. Work in schools, hospitals, and state-run media slowed. This follows the self-immolation of a journalist in December, an act of desperate protest echoing the public suicide of vegetable vendor Mohamed Bouzizi in 2011, the spark that ignited the revolution. The unrest puts Prime Minister Youssef Chahid in a tight spot. His country badly needs foreign investment, and the International Monetary Fund, parenthetically IMF, remains the most promising source of needed cash. The catch is that the IMF wants Shahid to prove he'll keep state spending within recommended limits. But this is an election year in Tunisia, and the Prime Minister knows he can't afford to ignore demands from frustrated civil servants for better pay or risk taking rough decisions when the results won't be seen until after votes are cast. At the same time, street unrest will discourage investment, and protesters demanding that the government tackle rising corruption, reduce income inequality, and create jobs won't be easy to placate. This isn't yet a crisis. IMF officials understand Shahid's predicament and want him to succeed, and the fund will probably follow its criticism of his government with more financial support. After another few weeks of fist-shaking, the unions will likely end up coming to a compromise with the government. Tunisia and its prime minister will all but certainly muddle through. That's hardly a ringing endorsement for democracy, though, particularly in a part of the world where leaders aren't eager to share power and few citizens have ever experienced democracy's benefits. This page, this area, shares a sidebar feature under the regular title Quick Talk, and the subject of the interview is Enes Kanter. Caption says, "The New York Knicks center reacts to the Turkish government seeking a warrant for his arrest after he repeatedly denounced its president." Article by Sean Gregory. It is a mini-interview. First question. If you get extradited, what do you think will happen to you? First answer by Enes Kanter. "I don't know if they can kill me, because there will be so much pressure. But there have been lots of reports out there that they torture people in jails." Question. What kind of torture would you expect? Answer. I have no idea. But I know that after that torture, I will not be able to play basketball again. Question. What's your main criticism of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan? Answer. Erdogan violates human rights. About 17,000 women and around 700 babies have been kept in jail. Turkey is the number one country in the world for putting journalists into jail. I love my country. Turkey could be the bridge between modern Islam and the West, but now that's impossible. Final question. Any message for your family in Turkey? Answer. If I could say one thing, I would tell them, I love you. And I would say, Mom, I miss your food. Entire mini-interview conducted by Sean Gregory with New York Knicks center Enes Kanter. Moving ahead, Ed, we are at the cover story, and the major section for the cover story is World, and the subsection is Migration. We join an article in progress. As always in politics, perception is reality. A 2017 study by Democracy Corps, a research firm co-founded by Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg, found that white Trump voters without a bachelor's degree who had voted for Obama and identified as Democrats or independents overwhelmingly felt that their culture was under siege. America, they reported, was divided between white, struggling, working-class people like, quote, us, unquote, and a non-white, often immigrant, quote, them, unquote. That sense of cultural siege held even in a community that remains more than 80% white, the study found. Researchers in a 2018 Harvard study on immigrant perception reported similar findings. Quote, while all respondents have misperceptions, unquote, about immigrant communities, the researchers wrote, quote, those with the largest ones are systematically the right wing, the non-college educated, and the low-skilled working in immigration-intensive sectors, unquote. Experts say correcting misperceptions about newcomers is only half the battle. The other half requires wealthy nations like the U.S. and much of Europe to rationalize their immigration policies, streamline asylum systems to eliminate torturous wait times, create a better system of temporary work visas, and consider offering safety nets to the low-wage native-born workers most likely to compete with immigrant labor. In the U.S., comprehensive immigration reform has consistently stalled in Congress despite bipartisan support. Legislative proposals to fix the system would require restructuring visa criteria and creating a legal path to citizenship for certain immigrant groups, including the so-called Dreamers who were brought to the U.S. illegally when they were children. Most bipartisan bills also include more funding for technology-based border enforcement. Instead of building a physical wall, as Trump has promised, existing bills propose cameras, radar towers, and fiber optic cables to secure the boundary. In the EU, stuttering efforts at immigration reform have focused on which EU countries are obliged to settle refugees and economic migrants, and how to distinguish between them. Immigration reform advocates have also focused on creating uniform integration programs across the EU and on efforts to enforce asylum denials. Your reader reports that this section is loaded with photographs, many of them entire page photographs, which we are paging through. But any long-term solution, experts insist, must address the reasons people leave home in the first place. In Central America, that means establishing security and rule of law. Texas Republican Representative Will Hurd, among others, has suggested implementing a comprehensive foreign aid plan for much of the region, comparable to the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe after World War II. Doris Meissner, one-time head of the former U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the director of the Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute, has suggested a similar international effort to funnel humanitarian aid and establish stability and export markets in nations from which tens of thousands of people flee each year. Destination nations can help by standardizing migrants' reception. Last year, world leaders debated two new agreements designed to establish international norms governing how nations should treat refugees and asylum seekers. In December, the UN General Assembly took steps in that direction, adopting two non-binding compacts. One of the agreements, the Global Compact for Migration, is the first ever UN agreement creating a comprehensive global approach to international migration. The U.S. did not participate in this negotiation and does not support the agreements. But protocols and treaties can, at best, hope to respond to the human emotions and hard realities that drive migration. No wall, sheriff, or headscarf law would have prevented, it's a long list of names, from leaving their homes. Migrants will continue to flee bombs, look for better-paying jobs, and accept extraordinary risks as the price of providing a better life for their children. The question now is whether the world can come to define the enormous population of international migrants as an opportunity. No matter when that happens, Ayman al-Badawi, a teacher from Syria who arrived in Unruhti, Germany in 2015, will continue to make a habit of reading German-language children's books to her three Syrian-born kids at night. Their German is better than hers, and they make fun of her pronunciation, but she doesn't mind. She is proud of them. At a time when anti-immigrant rhetoric is on the rise, she tells them, quote, "We must be brave, but we must also be successful and strong," unquote. Time notes this article was with reporting by Aaron Baker in Unruhti, Germany, Melissa Chan, Julia Lull, Gina Martinez, Thea Traff in New York, Ian Grillo in Tijuana, Abby Vasulis in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and Vivian Walt in Paris. The original author is not listed here. And the front page includes their name. Haley Sweetland Edwards is the main author of the cover story. Moving ahead, we are in a new section called The Future Is Now. Caption says, how fast can the world change? Today, half as many people live in extreme poverty as did in 1990. Supercomputers are so common that we forget them on the bus. And robots are poised to alter virtually everything about our lives. Here's your guide to keeping up. This introduces an entire subsection. There are many contributions from individuals. And your reader realizes what he just said. They are individual contributions from, indeed, individuals. Listed here, many article by Justin Trudeau. His headline is, put a price on pollution for cleaner growth. Time explains Trudeau is Prime Minister of Canada. He says, pollution isn't free. Billions around the world are already paying its price, from catastrophic floods to uncontrollable wildfires. We have to make a clean economy affordable for everyone, and we have a moral and economic imperative to act now. Pricing pollution is the single most powerful way to cut emissions while driving economic growth. Since doing so in 1991, Sweden has grown its economy and cut its emissions by 60% and 25% respectively. Here at home, the four provinces with a price on pollution in 2017 led the country in economic growth, while Canada led the G7. As in 2019, it is no longer free to pollute anywhere in Canada. Lower emissions, cleaner air, a stronger economy, the science and economics behind pollution pricing are settled. In the international fight against climate change, a national price on pollution should be the norm. Indeed, it is already a necessity. Entire item by Canada Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Also on this page, an observance by Melinda Gates. Time notes, Gates is co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Her headline is, Doubling Down on Saving Children's Lives. She writes, perhaps the greatest achievement of the past generation is the fact that the number of children who die each year has been cut in half. On my horizon in 2019, make it possible to cut child mortality rates in half again. Over the past three decades, the world has established a group of four organizations that have saved millions of lives. You've likely never heard of them, but if you pay taxes, you've helped fund their success. Gavi has immunized more than 700 million children. The Global Fund pays for HIV treatment for half the people living with the virus. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative has pushed us to the brink of wiping out the disease. The newest, the Global Financing Facility, is focused on women's and children's health, including helping women plan their families, which means their children will be more likely to survive and prosper. But some politicians in donor countries say they should invest less in the rest of the world. Will the world be able to cut child deaths in half again? It depends on what they decide. Observance by Melinda Gates. On this page, an observance by Fei-Fei Li. Times caption says, Li is co-director of Stanford University's Human-Centered AI Institute. And she writes, artificial intelligence is the quest to build machines with human-like intellectual capabilities. But in an industry known for its struggles with representation, how can we ensure they're inspired by the full range of human experience? Women make up only 12% of the AI research world and 26% of the tech workforce, while people of color fill less than 20% of leadership roles. My nonprofit, AI4ALL, AI for All, is working to reverse this trend by bringing firsthand experience in university AI labs to students of high school age who often feel left out of tech, girls, ethnic minorities, and residents of underserved communities. AI is a vast frontier with far more to explore than any single person, group, or even nation can manage alone. It will rank among our greatest technological achievements, and everyone deserves to play a role in shaping it. That, more than anything else, will ensure the world of 2030 is a future worth looking forward to. Entire observance by Fei-Fei Li. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, and it was a double issue, so our next will arrive in 2 weeks. I hope you learned from this issue. Please be sure to listen next time in 2 weeks. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5132. The number again, 919-832-5138. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you again for joining us and for your patience with your reader, for his omissions and errors and corrections. Please join us next time for Time.